This is Bristol Bay and Beyond for Friday, July 31st, 2015. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us for our weekly news magazine here on KDLG. Coming up in the next half hour.
The city does not want to be a landlord. We don't want to be in the real estate business. So the city's plan is to try to turn those properties over just as soon as it can.
Dillingham's mayor shares thoughts on the recent foreclosure of more than a dozen properties previously owned by Jim Bingman. We'll get reaction from others on what to do with a strip by the harbor the city plans to keep. As we move towards fall, it's time to hunt and gather. We'll tag along with a group of expert salmonberry harvesters and get an update on the overly healthy herd of caribou on the Nooshigak Peninsula.
750 is what we think is the optimal herd size down there. So, you know, simple math says we got 550 plus caribou that could be harvested.
Plus a visit with recently retired Wood Tick Chick Ranger Bill Burkon, and teenage Yupik singer Byron Nikolai shares a little about himself and his music. Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. In pursuit of what may be some 25 billion barrels of oil, drilling in the Arctic is now underway. Shell Oil confirmed Thursday night that its Polar Pioneer rig sent a drill bit spinning into the floor of the Chukchi Sea at about 5 p.m. Alaska time. More than 2,000 miles away, just a few minutes before the drill bit hit the sea floor, the company's icebreaker Finica managed to free itself from a blockade of protesters in Portland, Oregon, who had suspended themselves from a bridge across the Willamette River. Activists say climate change and the risk of an oil spill make drilling in the Arctic Ocean a dangerous mistake. The Bristol Bay sockeye season is winding down quickly everywhere but Togiak. Thursday's bay-wide catch was tallied at 44,000 sockeye, with few buyers and few boats still scratching away. The total catch this season now stands at 35.7 million and the total run 52.3 million sockeye. 18,000 of the catch yesterday came from the Togiak District, which has extra exclusive time this year. That's thanks to emergency action by the Board of Fish last Friday after petitioners requested pushing the transfer date from July 27th to August 15th. It was Board Member Fritz Johnson from Dillingham who amended that closer.
The petitioners here have requested an additional 20 days of exclusivity here. You know, it makes me wonder if the request is for, you know, perhaps more protection than maybe merited here.
Based on the average 8 to 10 days late that the other district's sockeye arrived, the board adopted August 5th as a one-time extension of the transfer time. There's been a noticeable tectonic activity in western Alaska over the past 2 weeks. The occasionally active Cleveland volcano in the east central Aleutians erupted briefly a week ago Tuesday morning, sending out an ash cloud into the sky. On Sunday, a 6.9 magnitude earthquake was recorded just 50 miles from Cleveland. And on Tuesday night, residents from the Kenai to Fairbanks reported feeling the 6.3 magnitude earthquake whose epicenter was located on this side of Cook Inlet across from Homer. Last week, the city of Dillingham announced it had foreclosed on all properties owned by Jim Bingman Sr., who owes the city hundreds of thousands of dollars in back taxes and fees, mostly from years of unpaid sales tax from several rental properties. City Manager Rose Louetta said Bingman's time to make good on the owed money ran out.
The redemption period for Bingman to reclaim his property ended on July 11th, and on July 13th, the city of Dillingham became owners of Jim Bingman properties.
The city has taken over as landlord for the rental units until the buildings can be sold, and it's keeping the strip of property by the boat harbor. The KDLG Crime and Safety Beat has gotten busy since the fishing season ended. DUIs and other crimes spiked in the past week, mostly in Naknek King Salmon. Two fishermen there were struck, one killed, walking along the Alaska Peninsula Highway last Saturday morning. The two men, but not the driver of the taxi, were believed to be drinking. 50-year-old Bernie Lopez of Dillingham is serving 10 days in jail for firing his rifle off while he was drinking aboard his boat in the harbor last weekend. David Crow, age 32, is often seen selling wares on the street in downtown Dillingham, was arrested on charges he sold pot to two teenage boys. And 54-year-old John Wassily has been charged with sexually assaulting his cellmate this week in the Dillingham jail when they were both sleeping off a night of having too much to drink. In other news, Dr. Misha Malikov, who some remember from previous excursions of the Nooshigak River, is on another exploration in Bristol Bay. The famed polar explorer from Russia is traveling by kayak from Homer to Naknek over the next 2 weeks. And funeral services for Hjalmar Ofi Olsen will be held tomorrow in Dillingham. Olson passed away at the beginning of July at the age of 75 following a lengthy battle with kidney failure. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Well, it's just been 4 years now since the city of Dillingham auctioned off the property known as Gladden's Apartments. The city claimed Dave Gladden, the previous owner, had failed to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes, mostly sales tax from the rental of his properties. Gladden alleges the city has no legal right to levy those taxes. Now the city has taken ownership of all the properties owned by Jim Bingman, including his numerous apartment buildings, for similarly failing to pay years' worth of taxes. Dillingham's Mayor Alice Ruby joins me now. Mayor, this can't be a position the city particularly likes to find itself in, having to seize a property. What's your take on this?
Well, that is one of the unfortunate jobs the council has to do. And they even stated it, you know, in the meeting when they took the final action here earlier this month that, you know, enforcing the code is our job. And sometimes it means doing some pretty sort of sad things, and foreclosure is one of those, where it's not something we prefer to do, but we have to be fair to everyone, so it's one of those steps we have to take.
In this instance, the court found that Mr. Bingman owed the city close to $300,000 in what was deemed sales tax and utilities from his commercial properties. That's a pretty substantial amount of money.
Oh, absolutely. That's actually just part of it. There's, you know, also the real property taxes, and I would note that it takes the city a long time to do foreclosure, and it's probably one of those things that the average citizen wouldn't know that it takes years for foreclosure to conclude. And so, you know, while we're foreclosing, there are additional taxes that are sort of adding up during the years after the period that we, you know, began to foreclose. So at this point, you know, the courts have acted on the amount that you described, you know, roughly $300,000. But there will be other expenses the city will have to try to recover. And again, just in fairness to all taxpayers.
Let me ask you two more questions, Mayor. One would be with the commercial properties located off of Fairview Drive, a couple of dozen tenants, it looks like there. I just can't imagine City of Dillingham wants to be a landlord for very long. What say you?
That's absolutely true, and that's the direction that the council has given the manager and our contractor, that if the first thing that we knew was that there are not enough rental properties available to evict people and, you know, be trying to distribute them around the community. So we did understand that we'd have to be landlords for a short period, but as short as possible, you know, to try to treat the people in the buildings fairly. But the city does not want to be a landlord. We don't want to be in the real estate business. So the city's plan is to try to turn those properties over just as soon as it can.
And the follow-up to that would be there's that stretch of property down by the harbor, and City Manager Rose Louetta told us last week that the City Council has decided to keep that and to probably clean it and put it to some public use. What are your thoughts about what we might see with that property in the next year or two?
Well, definitely the council's real concerned about seeing the property cleaned up so that it's made safe. There's been concern by citizens for a long time that there's a lot of stuff there. Not only is it visually kind of a problem, but they just want it cleaned up, and it's likely going to be harbor-related. I mean, it's adjacent to the harbor. It's property that would probably be suitable for, you know, fishery-related or harbor-related uses, and that's, I think, what the council's vision is, too.
Mayor Ruby, before we let you go, election season right around the corner. Filing opens 2 short weeks away here. Any thoughts on your intent to run again for your seat?
I think I did let a few people know that I will, you know, declare candidacy again. And there's things like this particular case where I really want to see them through. And so, there's a lot to do in the city, and I think I'd like to keep being a part of it.
Alice Ruby is Dillingham's mayor. Alice, thanks for the update and the time as always.
You're welcome.
This week, we sent KDLG's Matt Martin out to find out what others think the city should do with its recently acquired property down by the boat harbor.
Traffic rolls by on the freshly paved stretch of Kanakanak Road in front of the Dillingham Boat Harbor. The new and clean asphalt stands in contrast to the jumbles of scrap metal, the old VW bus, and the derelict boats.
It's kind of an eyesore. Dillingham's a pretty beautiful community, but then that's the first thing you see coming into town, so it'd be nice to see it cleaned up.
Local Dillingham resident Nick Schollmeyer.
With two little kids, I'd love to see a park there.
Billy Benedict rents space on the property for the UPOPM fireworks stand.
I would just like to see it become clean and the junk towed away. And then once it's clean, I think it's an excellent opportunity for the city of Dillingham to encourage small businesses.
Benedict suggests the city offer long-term leases so people can develop businesses on the property. She says that could add to the economy of the town.
I think that they have the opportunity to stimulate that and help people out and increase their revenues through taxes.
Other people around town had their own ideas for the space.
What would you like to see there if you could put any?
Maybe ice cream shop or a store, a little store.
There could be a little cafe there. There could be a small recreation center there. So something for people to do in the downtown area would be excellent.
That was Kevin Nunn and Tom Beasley. Gabe Dunham is the Marine Advisory Program agent, and while he has no position on the foreclosure itself, he did share what other communities in Alaska have done with similar properties. One suggestion was to build a communal cold storage facility.
Where businesses and people can either rent the, or lease, I suppose is a more appropriate term, lease the processing space, which is a certified commercial processing space, or they can lease space and capacity in the long-term freezer facility that's connected to the facility. I've heard local individuals state a possible need for sort of a fisherman's center where people can hang out, take showers, perhaps have internet access, that sort of thing.
Some also suggested moving the Saturday farmers market to the location. All arguably good ideas, but what will eventually greet drivers as they move in and out of downtown is yet to be known. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
Hunting season is upon us, and we hope to bring you conversations over the next few weeks with some of the managers in the know. On account of it's the first opportunity of the season, our first guest is Andy Aderman, wildlife biologist at the Togiak Refuge, home to the ample herd of caribou down on the Nooshagak Peninsula. Andy, good to have you in the studio.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be here.
Saturday is the kickoff of fall hunting in a big way because caribou opens. Tell me a little bit about the Nooshagak Peninsula herd. There's some interesting things lately about that herd because there's a lot of them.
Right. The herd has been doing exceptionally well, and part of that is because of the poor winters for people getting down there the last two winters. It has really grown, and it's at its biggest size in the history of that herd, I believe.
Briefly, what is the history, by the way? I forget every year, but there's not a long history to this herd. It was introduced a decade or so ago.
A little longer than that, okay. 1988.
Oh, 88, okay.
Yeah, caribou were captured over on the Alaska Peninsula out of the northern Alaska Peninsula herd. About 150, 160 were caught and brought over here. So from that start of about 150 animals, that herd grew very rapidly the first 10 years, peaked at about 1,400 in 97, 98, and then started to go down and then dropped rather quickly to about 450, 500 animals as of about 2006.
All right.
So about 10.
About a decade ago.
About 10, yeah.
Yep.
10 years after the peak, it went down, and then it started to slowly come back up, and it has been increasing.
Caribou do this, right? They seem to find their, between the hunting pressure and the predator pressure and the habitat pressure, they go up and down, they hit these peaks and valleys. Do they ever just balance out at some thing, or that's never going to happen?
I think there are probably some examples around if you look for them. One thing with this herd is it's a resident herd. Unlike a lot of caribou herds are migratory. They're pretty predictable in where they go at certain times of the year. These caribou, for the most part, stay on the peninsula. We do get some that wander up to the lower Snake River and cross it. Some have gone to the west, Kalukuk, even as far as Twin Hills, but they all seem to end back up on the peninsula.
Well, I wouldn't mind a bit if one stumbled right over here to Kinakinak. That'd be fine with me. But.
Well, we need to have an open season here.
Ah.
If you're west of Wood River, it's in 17C. That's a to-be-announced
hunt. Oh, that's correct. Right.
So
that is one thing to keep in mind for this hunt are the boundaries. For the average person in this time of the year is probably boating or flying. How do you get to the right spot here?
Well, when you go and get your permit, they should give you a map that shows the boundary. And being a federal subsistence hunt, it can only happen on federal lands, in this case, Togiak Refuge.
You track these caribou throughout the year with radio collars and with some aerial surveys. What's the size, if I didn't get that specifically earlier? There are quite a few right now.
There is. I was last down there a month ago, and caribou were grouped up very nice in two large groups, and I got good photographs of them, counted those. I had a couple of collars that weren't part of the group, and I saw a few uncollared animals. I came up with a minimum of 1,313.
Where's that leave you managing that you hope to see culled this year between the fall and winter hunts?
Well, we're way over where we'd like to be. In fact, 750 is what we think is the optimal number for a long-term herd size down there. So, simple math says we got 550-plus caribou that could be harvested to get us
wow.
down to that 750.
At one of the local Nooshigak AC meetings, some potential regulation changes were proposed to make hunting them easier. It is a little bit of a difficult trip for people this time of the year. It's easier by snow machine, but it was brought up of potentially same-day airborne hunts, maybe increasing the bag limits. Is anything on the table right now going into this fall season? Are there any regulation changes?
No, nothing going into this fall season. Everything's the same as it has been the last couple of years. The harvest limit is two caribou.
Either sex.
Unlike the other areas outside of the peninsula, you can get your two caribou the first day. They can both be bulls. They can both be cows or one of each. Or you can get one now, and if you want to get another one in the winter, that's your choice entirely.
Well, what a fantastic hunt to have available here in our backyard for the Western communities that are open to this subsistence hunt. Where did you see them grouped up, by the way? Any tips or advice on where to steer to?
Wouldn't you know, they were on the private land.
Oh, they were?
They were, but that was a month ago, Dave,
okay.
I think.
Well, this time last year when I talked to you, you said to stay out of the bugs. They were generally grouped up in places where the wind was blowing the strongest, typically on the western side of the peninsula down south, because the bugs were so bad.
That's where I've seen them quite a bit, is down the southwest coast, sometimes right on the beach.
Any other tips or thoughts or suggestions for first-time hunters or even seasoned folks that are thinking about planning a trip?
Well, just plan ahead. Weather is what weather can be. We can still have some pretty warm days here, so if you're going to go down there, it's maybe a little tough to
take care of that meat,
have a backup plan.
Sure.
Get a map along with your permits, and good luck.
Andy Aderman, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
That was Hunting, Now to Gathering. When the fisher put up, Bristol Bay residents head out in droves to secret spots on hillsides and flats in search of berries. Last week, KDLG's Hannah Colton tagged along with some avid Dillingham salmonberry pickers during this early and abundant season.
Around 9 in the morning, Kim Williams meets up with her sister-in-law Liz Johnson and Aunt Judy Samuelson. This is day 10 of salmonberry picking for this team. And William says it's been a good haul so far.
How many bags you put away?
37.
counted them last night. Yeah. I got 40.
Wow.
I think Auntie Judy's got us beat.
Yeah.
They load plastic buckets and quart-sized Ziploc bags onto their four-wheelers. Williams leads the group out onto the tundra, picking her way between the swampy patches. She's heading toward one of their closely guarded berry spots.
We have spots that we go in and regularly look at because we've been there 30 years. Judy, 30, huh? At least 30. So for over 30 years, we have spots that we go back and check. And some years they're there and some years they're not.
Last year was an off year with no salmon berries to be found. Williams says heavy wind and a late frost killed the delicate blossoms.
When they blossom, they're a white blossom that are really easy to, you know, rain, a lot of rain will knock that blossom off. The wind, a lot of things can happen so that they don't bury.
This time around, conditions were apparently right and early. Williams says they started scouting for berries on July 9th, a week and a half earlier than usual.
We always know that when you hear the cranes out on the berry flat, berries are ready. Mm-hmm. And when the fireweed are blooming, berries are ready. That's the sign to tell you to go look.
The morning's destination is a prime berry spot that the ladies have visited before. We arrive to find the flats thick with the big, bright orange berries that Williams says they favor.
We want them big. We don't like picking them small. We don't like them white. We don't like them with black dots.
What else? We don't like them too hard.
We don't like them hard, so you have to clean them. Yeah, they have to be just right.
These perfect berries could sell for $100 a gallon or more. But William says they won't put any on the market.
Mm-mm. No. We never sell.
I did one year, my old ones, when I had like 80 some almost baked.
We're not hoarders.
Yeah, look, we only
have... William says these berries will go straight into her father's freezer for a year's worth of aguduk.
Usually for our family, we take out two bags every time we're going to have a meal of salmon berry aguduk. Then I take blueberries or blackberries and add it to it, and it stretches it. Now, Auntie Judy, she likes just strictly salmon berry aguduk. She's a picking fiend.
The three women pick the area for several hours, with a light breeze keeping the bugs off. Before leaving for new territory, they try to tally up their haul from just this one spot.
11 gallons!
That's really good, boy.
11 gallons out of here. Holy.
One pack!
That's lots. No wonder our backs are hurting. No wonder our backs are hurting.
By late afternoon, this crew is running low on ibuprofen and on freezer space. It's about time to call it the end of a successful salmon berry season. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Amidst the state's budget cuts over the past 2 years, one of the two ranger positions at the Woodtickchick State Park was finally eliminated. The position removed was the senior spot held by Supervisory Park Ranger Bill Burkon, who chose to end his 27-year-long career with parks earlier this summer as the staffing change took place. Burkon had held the Woodtickchick job for nearly a decade. His wife Patty retired from a fish and game job this year too, and the two of them spent their first summer off in some 30 years volunteering in the park, spending several weeks at the state cabin at the top of the Igulopac River. While Burkon might still be sore at seeing his position cut, his career ended, and the park he cherishes left what many now feel is underprotected, he was all smiles when I and former Togiak Refuge manager Paul Lieberg flew up to pay him a visit last week.
He is home.
Holy smokes!
We thought we could sneak up on you.
We can't sneak up around here. How you doing?
Good. You?
Good. Good. Doing well.
The Igulopac Cabin sits on site of one of the region's most sought-after sport fish destinations, right at the top of the rainbow trout-rich river that drains Lake Beverly into Lake Nurka. Area lodges are just starting to bring more anglers to this spot this season. Bill and Patty can keep an eye on the activity from their front porch amidst what he describes as just a few other duties now that he's just volunteering in the park.
Be a presence here, and then do a little bit of maintenance here. And there's always a few little light carpentry duties that show up. But I've taken this opportunity to do a little more exploring in areas that I've seen when I was working. You just get to see it either flying over it, or you spend a couple hours there. So this time we are actually exploring some new places, new little drainages, and checking out the fishery. Found some king salmon in a creek I never even knew. Well, two kings, they were a spawning pair, in a little mud creek down here on Nerka. Never anticipated that. So that was...
Exploring spots in Wood Tick Chick that most fly over or pass by in boats on step has become one of Bill's favorite pastimes. I had the privilege of joining he and two other rangers on a float trip of the Tick Chick River several years back and learned from Bill how to appreciate more of what the park offers, like quiet creeks, easy hikes along game trails and drainages, and hidden grayling holes.
It's awesome. People use the word awesome, you know, as a slang term, but it's awe-inspiring, a lot of this stuff. And that when you're sitting up there in these places, actually Patty and I were talking about it, the management decision should be made out here by the people that are here doing the work, experiencing it, seeing it on a day-to-day basis. Instead of over there, they have the managers aren't in tune with what's happening here.
That thinking and occasional outspokenness had not exactly earned Burkhan many favors with his administrative hierarchy. As one example, they did not seem to appreciate how fiercely Burkhan held his ground against a recent bizarre proposal to study building a dam at Chukumanuk Lake to supply power to Bethel. The proposed dam and even most of the actual studies were not in keeping with the park's charter or management plan, which Burkhan never shied away from pointing out. When we sat down later, I asked Bill what it is about Wood Tick Chick, the largest of its kind in the nation, he believes is so special and unique.
Still, the most impressive thing to me about the park, and it's something I observed, I think, here on my first visit 9 years ago, was that it's a salmon nursery. It's an intact ecosystem. I always say that, but it's true. It's intact. It's pristine. And here we are, 1.9 million sockeye heading up the Wood River, vast majority up into the park. They're up there. They're infiltrating that lake system. Every little tributary, little creek, there's about 30 of them that flows all the way down from Grant River. All these little unnamed creeks, they're just stacked with sockeye ready to spawn. And what happens in the spring, Dave? The outmigration, right? Billions of smolt migrate out to the ocean. So you have this complete cycle every year, and it's working. It's functional. It's working. And what do you get with all those salmon? You know, they're the hinge pin for the life in the park. The osprey, the eagles, the bears, the rainbow trout, the grayling, the insects, everything depends on those salmon.
And so, the anglers and the activity and all the rest.
The recreational opportunity that comes along with all of that. So our forefathers, if you will, and maybe mothers of the park, the politicians back in the 70s had the foresight to set this area aside, as they did other park areas like the Chugach, Kachemak Bay State Park, Denali State Park. There's quite a few of them out there. And Wood Tick Chick is part of that generation of land stewardship and preservation of these areas. And we are very fortunate that previous generations have set these areas aside for us to utilize and enjoy now. And I believe it's our role to continue with that stewardship and leave a legacy to the future generations.
Bill and Patty Burkhan wrapped up their 3 weeks volunteering at the Pack Cabin last weekend. No one is there now. They bought a camper shell for their truck and plan to spend the rest of the summer and fall exploring other nooks and crannies around the state. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Before we go this week, 17-year-old drummer and singer Byron Nikolai from Tuksuk Bay was in Dillingham this week sharing his music and message with kids and the community. He made time for us to... It's good to have you in town. It's good to have you in the studio. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, it's my first time in Dillingham, and it's really beautiful. It's going great so far.
Good to hear.
A lot of nice people here.
It's good to hear.
Plan on coming back some other time.
Well, I'm sure you'll be welcome back for certain. You've become quite the sensation here in the last, 2 years?
It started in November.
Last November?
Yeah, no, last November.
Because you posted one song on Facebook.
Well, a couple of them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me why you did that and what's happened since to you.
Well, I've been singing most of my life, and I just, you know, I felt like I wanted some other people to hear my singing, and I created a page called I Sing You Dance, which started off really small. It only had like 300 likes for the past 8 months until I posted an Anaconda video. It's a song by Nicki Minaj, and I just like kind of did a parody on it, so I think it's that video that helped me grow a lot.
Probably a little bit of a social media Google aspect there. You got found out.
Yeah.
All right, where have you been since to take your music, by the way?
Oh, so far I've been to Anchorage a couple times. I've been to Bethel a couple times. And I've been to Seattle, and I've been in Washington, D.C. But then I was talking to this lady who got me to Seattle, and I think she wants me back there, and then I was talking to her, and she said that she wanted me to do a kind of like a duet with Macklemore.
No, really?
Because he lives in Seattle.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be cool.
It will be cool. It will be something else.
So you've stumbled into this kind of career now, almost, or you're becoming a musician. Are you ready for that?
I'm still trying to get ready because I'm still in high school, and I feel like it's going to be a lot busier when I'm out of school.
So another year until maybe really get going. But for the time being, you've been representing the Alaska Native culture in the past several months in a way that is uplifting and positive, and it's encouraged other youth to maybe follow the same. Is that part of your motivation?
Okay, this is like kind of how I see it. Our ancestors, they worked hard to survive a really long time ago. You know, the winters were bad. There was barely any food, and they worked hard. And one of the things they kept going is our cultural way of dancing, yugak, and drumming, jawiak. And then they've worked hard for those things, so if we just dropped them, they would have died for nothing in those bad weathers and with no food at all. So just kind of thinking of that, how much they sacrificed to survive and how much they worked hard to survive.
Can the music and the culture help people today come through hard times?
I know it definitely helps me. I mean, you know, it's not so easy out in the village. And most of the time when I'm home alone, I just go in my room and lock the door and then just sing my heart out until someone comes in. Or I just go on walks at the beach and kind of sing at the cliffs, you know, just some songs.
Do you write most of your own music?
All of them.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
Would you share one with us now?
Yes, I could do that. Okay, this is a song my cousin made, but then I just kind of played around with a little bit.
Imakhbim shoka watinika kegawli Aikhiya ingikhiya Nunanik shuni kamiga shumpni Yikhi Angyaogloka Aya gali imakh bim shoka watini ka ke gawi ay khia ingi khia nunani khuni kamiga shamtni
You have a terrific voice.
Thank you. I've been singing most of my life. Started out when I was 7, so there's been a lot of practice.
tell the non-Yupik speakers what that song's about, if you don't mind.
This song is about I'm traveling by boat into the ocean, and it's a beautiful day while I'm going seal hunting.
That's a very nice song. Byron Nicolai, it's been a pleasure to talk with you briefly here, and glad to have you in town, and I know we'll see you back, and we wish you the best in this budding career and next year in your senior year. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me here.
And that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond, our weekly news magazine on KDLG. While we quietly relent the relinquishing of the fisheries report and the fishing season it accompanied, the news crew here at KDLG is gladly settling back into our normal routine. Find out more about our schedule and find most of our stories online at kdlg.org. Speaking of schedules, don't forget to take a peek skyward tonight. It's the second full moon of the calendar month of July, so it's called a blue moon, though it won't necessarily appear that way. I'm Dave Benninger. See you next week. Bomb, 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 bomb